Welcome to Soul Sciences. I'm your host, Charlene. Many of these podcasts explore writers, especially memoir writers, as they examine the journey of their lives. From time to time, you will discover a totally unique podcast on subjects ranging from muons to those lights that flash when you press your eyelids and anything in between. I hope you enjoy today's program on Soul Sciences. Hi, everyone. It is my great pleasure and privilege today to bring to you once again Alice Talmadge, all the way from the West Coast of the USA. Yes, Alice, where are you?
Oregon.
Oregon. We just watched the Rajneesh documentary.
Yes. Yes.
That was quite well done, I thought, and very even and yet revealed. So anyone who's interested in that amazing bit of history where this whole cult takes over part of Oregon, Antelope, Oregon.
Right.
Population 40 to begin with.
I know.
And so much of the documentary was actually memoir in a way.
Well, yes, and illuminatingly, different perspectives of the same event. So it's memoir on a turning gyre, you know, like this person sees it this way, this person saw it that way, this person saw it that way. So yes, very much so.
And did you find that when you wrote your memoir, Now I Can See the Moon, did you find there were other perspectives that took you through a different change as you began to write about them?
Not my personal experience, because I don't have the greatest memory. And so I really went back and tried to use a lot of primary sources to bolster what I thought had happened. So I talked to family members, I relied on journals, there were medical records, I used my niece's journals. I went to great, great lengths to portray as realistically as I could, or as accurately as I could, my experience. And when there were holes, I had help filling them in. So I won't say it was a community perspective, but there wasn't a whole lot that, on that angle, that I needed to change from what I had felt happened.
So other people's experience of the times sounded to you when you recorded them, when you got their opinion, when you look back on journals, it all seemed to make the same sense that you were making of the circumstance.
Yeah. Yeah, it got fuller and more fleshed out and deeper, but at its core, it was very much parallel to what I had remembered. So that was good. Now, the attitudes about the social panic that I write about, there are definitely different perspectives of that. And when I started, I didn't know anything about it. I had to do a lot of research, and I had to figure out, okay, who are the people that, it was controversial. People didn't agree with each other, especially about recovered memories. It's still very controversial. So I had to read a lot and determine for myself who I thought was most on the beam as far as the research went.
Would you open up for our listeners a little bit of this social panic you mentioned? I'm not sure everyone quite gets it. I didn't until I read your book, and then I went, oh, I get what that is.
Yeah. Well, it was this cultural phenomenon occurred in the 1980s and into the mid-1990s, and it was social panic over child sex abuse. And I did not know what some people call it a hysteria, some people call it a moral panic instead of a social panic. Those are kind of sociological, anthropological terms, but it's when something causes a culture to kind of get caught up in a swirl where logic and common sense fly out the window, and pretty much people are very, very energized and motivated by self-righteous anger, by outrage, paranoia, rumor, all those things really take over. And for some reason, the cultural atmosphere or environment was ripe for this kind of thing to happen. So it began with accusations against workers in child care centers of just not typical, or not, I don't even want to say typical child abuse, but what we're used to reading, but the very, very extreme, heinous, sadistic types of things. And it started in Southern California, and it just made its way across the country. There was an incident, like I told you, in Hamilton, Ontario. That was one of the first. That wasn't a child care center. That was of children making accusations against foster parents, I believe. And it morphed into actual reports of satanic ritual abuse. Young women from all over the country started coming up with very, very similar stories about these cults and this abuse. And the underpinning was, what is memory? And how factual is memory? That was kind of like the questions that fed into this this panic. Because in the child care abuse trials, the way the children were interviewed by investigators determined what memories they ended up claiming as truth. And with the ritual abuse thing, it was like, okay, are these memories reflections of actual things that happened, or are they creative, I don't know, not fantasies, but are they false memories created in the course of therapy or other kinds of suggestive environments? And so the social panic, it wasn't just the people who claimed these things. It was police, it was investigators, it was child care workers, it was social workers, it was judges, it was juries. People just really, journalists, the media, they all came down on the side of these victims who, in many cases, they weren't victims. It was just a product of a disturbing time. And by the late 1990s, it had died down, but it made an impact on the culture, I think.
I can't help but make the association when you talk about the profile of what a social panic is, how people get self-righteous and they dichotomize, so there's us against them, is how I'm hearing you talk about it. Yeah. Angry and completely convinced that they know what the truth is. I can't help but understand this in terms of the greater American political scene right now with Trump. I see it as a kind of social panic, if that's our definition of social panic.
Yeah.
That there's not a lot of reason or stability or rationality being brought to mind around his presidency, but there is a tremendous amount of emotional hype.
Yeah.
You have any thoughts on that?
I wrote an essay for Huffington Post about a month ago that they published, and it was about truth, and how truth is one of the first victims of a social panic, because truth just doesn't make any difference. And I wrote in that, and I don't think that what we're going through here is a social panic, but I do believe there are elements that are adding to this willingness for some reason for people to embrace alternative facts, to allow or to tolerate statements that are not substantiated by truth. And I find that to be a common element, and I find this, you know, very upsetting, because we've gone through a time in our cultural history where that was already true, and we saw what happened. I mean, you know, dozens of people were thrown into prison for, you know, 2 decades. They hadn't done anything. And the district attorneys went to great lengths to not let them off the hook. For what reason? And so it's kind of the same thing. You get your stance and you stand on it, and you're not going to move no matter what factual evidence is presented to you. And I find that, you know, troublesome.
Deeply upsetting, I should say, at the highest level of the land. And I wouldn't say that many countries are devoid of that. I think there's probably a stream of that in almost all top-level politics.
All authoritarian regimes determine, that's what they do. They determine what the truth is. That's why they control the media, because they don't want any voice that goes against them gets silenced. And, you know, that's one of many of the things that's disturbing, because that's kind of the pattern I see happening.
Yes.
But we're supposed to be talking about memoir, not politics.
And you are a journalist, and you do have experience with journalism. How difficult or how different it was to write memoir compared to journalism and the other journalists and the other writing experiences you've had?
Well, I could go on about that.
Please do.
Well, I've been writing you know, newspaper articles. I worked for newspapers and magazines, so I'm used to writing objective journalism and doing research and keeping myself out of the story, basically. On the other hand, I've all for years I've written separate from that first person essays. So I was used to that too, and I had a particular voice that I don't know I have found or discovered that worked for me. Generally, they were kind of humorous. So when it came to do this memoir, nothing about it is humorous, at least not that I've found. One of my biggest, most daunting challenges was to combine the journalism aspect of my research into the panic with my personal story. I would have never known about this thing if I hadn't had a personal relationship with it. And I think a lot of, you know, readers are in the same way. A lot of people said, I never even heard about this. And, oh, I vaguely remember that going on in the 80s, but I wasn't really sure. And so in my early drafts, I remember one of the people who read it gave me the feedback. Well, she goes, it sounds like two different people are writing this. You tell your story in the first half of the book, and then in the second half, there's all this journalism, and there's no, they're not cohesive. So I spent an awful lot of time trying to yoke the two to not, I didn't want it to be an analysis. I didn't want it to be investigative because I didn't do that much original work on my own. I used investigatively speaking. But I wanted readers to understand enough so that they could appreciate the conundrum I found myself in and how my family found itself in, where we didn't know what a social, nobody knew what a social panic was. You know, when you're just in the middle of it and you're flailing around blindly. So it wasn't so much writing in the two different styles as combining them.
And just to make it clear for listeners who may not have heard your first podcast with me 2 or 3 months back, the stakes in your family were extremely high because your niece was showing evidence of social panic behavior and, in fact, at a certain point did pass away. So yes. This was not a kind of let's sit around the table and discuss what's happening in the neighborhood. This was right in the middle of the family at the heart of it.
Right, right. Yeah, she was emotionally fragile before she became enmeshed into the social panic, but kind of tipped her over the edge.
The idea of social panic does sound a lot like the witchcraft and the witches at the trials.
So many parallels. So many parallels. I read Stacy Schiff's book, The Witches, which she wrote fairly recently, and it was terribly, terribly hard reading for different reasons, but oh my God, she wasn't writing about the social panic of the 1980s, but some of the things she wrote about the witchcraft trial, they could have been just poof, transferred 300 years right into this. And I write about this in the book. The social panics activate a very deep, deep part of our psyches, and I think, and they surface periodically throughout Western civilization, you know, since the Romans for a long, long time. And I think that's one of the reasons they're hard to get a handle on, because they almost escape words and concepts, because it goes into a place that's deeper than words and concepts. It's pure emotion and fear.
Superstition comes to mind.
Yeah, the kind of thing that feeds that, only on a grand scale, and it's kind of funneled through laws and juries and actions to make it seem socially acceptable. Like the witch trials, they had trials in Salem. They had trials. So they try to normalize it, but it's not normal. But at the time, people thought it was. And one thing I did learn is different communities were hit by the panic in different ways. Certain communities, it was the daycare abuse fear that occurred. Utah really got hit by the satanic ritual abuse aspect of the panic for whatever reason. So it came out of nowhere. People didn't know what hit them, and they just didn't even have time to stand back and think about it rationally. They just, oh my God, this is happening. How are we going to save our children?
You know, the ritual abuse, I see it as a parallel to what Dan Brown writes about in his books.
I don't know him. I know his name, but...
Yeah. Right. He writes about the Da Vinci Code. He writes about this idea of there's a cult at the top who are controlling so much and so forth. It seems to me that, as you've mentioned, at the heart of it is the perplexity we feel over memory. And it seems to me that one of the things that we've gained since the 1990s, partly through just having decades of trying to understand sexual abuse, is we have a list of behaviors that we could pretty much say if a person is exhibiting these, they've been sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
And with children, one of the things is they stop talking.
Mm.
They withdraw. You know, and with adults, that can happen too, right? And then there are the distortions in relating to their life as it was prior to the sexual mm-hmm. abuse. So the distortions in an older person, a 14, 15, 16-year-old, might be drug and alcohol abuse, throwing their life away suddenly, those kinds of things. PTSD, mm-hmm. in other words.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that one of the tools we didn't have back then
mm-hmm.
was this accumulation of profile that says these particular behaviors indicate a strong possibility of sexual abuse. What do you say to that?
Well, a couple things. I'm certainly no expert in that area, but it just so happens that people did compile a list of behaviors, but not about sexual abuse, but about ritual abuse. And they were just kind of made up. I mean, they didn't have, the list you're talking about have background, they have legs, they have a foundation.
Yes,
of,
they do.
People have done studies and all this. The ritual abuse folks, they just kind of made up these behaviors and said, if you see any of these, well, then the person was, you know, one, sexually abused, and two, probably ritually abused, but with no foundation. The people had theories that were just ideas that they pulled out of the ether, but somehow they had a quality that...
They took on a gravitas that was not...
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's happened since then is that I don't think people were as aware of how influential interviewers are, both with people who are vulnerable emotionally and mentally, and with children. How suggestible we are, how plastic our memories are, how much they change depending on the environment in which we're remembering them, in which how much time has passed, and how our feelings towards that time period that we're trying to remember, or what other people say, oh no, it didn't happen like that, it happened like this, and oh yeah, okay. So I don't think we're done as a culture investigating memory, but we're further along.
Yeah. We are. One of the things that I say to clients is that if you have siblings, they had a different set of parents than you did. So don't look for uniformity. By the time the parents have a second child, they have a totally different toolkit
mm-hmm.
and a totally different set of their own memories of how to be parents
mm-hmm.
and how memory builds identity. And so if there's a third child or a fourth, then you've got, again, another set of identities that the parents have accumulated and accrued that come into play when they go into their parenting. And so people very often go, well, you were there, you were in the room, you thought that. And the person goes, no, I don't remember any of that. And so I think we're kind of left with this, well, where are we? And I always say the thing to focus on is your own body.
Yeah.
Because your body can't lie.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't know how.
Yeah.
And so if you're getting a strong reaction physically from some thought that you're having, it might be worth investigating. But that has to be intrapersonal. It's not interpersonal. It's not someone else suggesting to you, oh, this or that.
Right.
And
I think one of the things you said that really contributes to the whole controversy over recovered memories and false memory is that we base our identity on our memories. And so if someone suggests to us that we've been carrying around a false memory for 15, 20 years, Not just a matter of people seeing things differently, but truly a memory that does not reflect anything that actually happened, the person's really challenged, because what happens to our identity if we drop our memories or have to face the fact that no, this didn't happen? I think it just contributes another piece of the puzzle about false memory and recovered memories and all of that.
I mean, it's reiterative. It goes the other direction as well, which is to say that if you have to face a memory that you don't want to face,
yes,
you have to change your whole identity becomes very suspect.
Yes.
And it can feel very, very shaky for a period of time. And suddenly there's an explosion of something and you know, certainly this did happen. What else is possible that you didn't remember?
Yeah.
And so the whole, that is what it, I think it really rests on, is this notion of identity. And if it's a false memory, having to let go of that to cultivate a sense of stability again in the memories that are verifiable. And if it's coming from, no, these are heinous memories that you didn't want, but that probably did take place, then stretching your consciousness to go, but I'm still here and I've done well since, and how can I build? And that explains why I had these troubles over here, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So I think TV is doing a lot with that now.
Oh.
I don't know. I like to watch crime stories, and you'll see a lot of people struggling with PTSD, but they don't know what the PTSD is, or they'll disassociate, they'll leave the moment and go, and the way that the program will suggest those little tiny flashbacks of memory, they'll be disconnected and just like these fast images, and you see the person get really uncomfortable, and then they're drawn back into the moment.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So yes. Dealing with false memory, I haven't seen that as much, but it's fascinating, people.
It is fascinating, and it's fascinating how we build identity based in those memories, and we do that right into our identity as a culture, our identity as a city, as a province or a state, as a country, as a nationality. It's all there, and so the question about what all those memories, collective memories, are about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is just so fascinating, and I feel like we're just skimming the surface, but we have to bring this to a close. Alice, is there anything else you'd like to say? I'd like you to talk to people about your book. It's a really well-written book, and it's so interesting to read.
Thank you. No, I think, you know, as I said, you just start one place and you end up somewhere else, and I had to be careful writing the book that I didn't go off into all sorts of, you know, way out there, because one thing leads to another. This is fundamental stuff. That's why these cultural things happen. They ripple through because they affect something in so many of us. Yeah.
Absolutely. And your book is called?
Oh, Now I Can See the Moon.
And where is it available?
For people, you can find it on Amazon, and you can go to my website at alicetalmadge.com, and I have several order buttons.
Great. And I'll have those links at the bottom of my page when I'm putting this out for people. Thank you so much, Alice. Will you come back and speak with us again?
Yes, you can just get me, you have my email address.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Charlene.
Thanks, Alice.
Okay,
bye
bye-bye.
For now. That's it. That's all for today's program. Many thanks to Kevin MacLeod for this lovely music called Carefree. For more of my works, including excerpts from my books, go to www.soulsciences.net. And remember, take good care of each other. Bye for now.